The friendly radio show about computers and the net. BFBS Multimedia.
BFBS Multimedia. Broadcasting around the world on FM and available as a podcast or a download to an MP3 player near you. This is BFBS Multimedia, your user-friendly guide to computers and the internet here on BFBS Radio 2. I'm Mark Phillips. Normally you'd hear from Dave Raven. Regular BFBS listeners may know that Dave hasn't been very well of late, so we do wish him the very best. He's listening at home and recuperating, and I hope very much to have him back on Multimedia soon. Every Christmas, we try and do a very special show for you on Multimedia, and this year is no exception. So we've got a panel of technology experts with us. We've got Brian Betts, who's a mobile technology journalist. Welcome, Brian.
Hello there.
Barry Collins, the news and features editor from PC Pro magazine.
Hello, Mark.
We have from Which, the consumer champions, Kerry Stanaway.
Hi there.
And finally, from the Square Group, we have Paul Gibbons. Now, the Square Group are one of the leading Apple retailers and service centres. I think that's fair to say.
That's correct.
Okay, welcome everybody. Where do we start? I suppose if we start with mobile telephony, everything seems to be up in the air at the moment. There's been a lot of confusion about what's happening with mobile telephones. The phones themselves are changing as well. The biggest single thing, I suppose, is the iPhone. Would that be fair to say that, Brian?
Yeah, actually, I had my first good look at an iPhone just recently. I have to admit, I'd assumed it was mainly for, you know, diehard Mac fans and fashion victims, but it's a lot more clever than that. But I'm actually waiting to see what the competitors are going to come up with to match the iPhone format, this format of a landscape or twistable screen. Everything is done by a touch on screen, and importantly, it's multi-touch. It's not just single touch like most of the touch screens to date.
I think this is what we've said on the show in the past, is that it's not the iPhone itself that's going to be the important thing. It's the fact that it's really taken the design of the phone user interface back to basics, and they've really scrapped everything that's gone before and started again. How can we make this better?
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, we've seen PDAs with a built-in phone in the past, but the software has never really worked well as a phone. It's never really worked well as an MP3 player. Everything is still too close to the desktop, and it's not actually designed as a device that's going to be mobile.
Barry, what do you think? Have you had a chance to play with an iPhone? Silly question, I bet you have.
Yeah, I've had it in my hands a few times. I agree, it's an incredibly impressive piece of hardware and software, and I think it has got the rest of the industry rattled. We hear the last couple of days that Microsoft is publicly talking about completely revamping Windows Mobile, which it never does. Microsoft rarely reveals plans much in advance, but seems to be giving snippets away to various press sites. So I'm sure it's got the rest of the phone industry rattled. I think we've seen Nokia have a faint stab at trying to do iPhone-like phones, but I think the rest are so far behind at the moment that it's going to take him to the middle of the next year at least before we start seeing any real credible competition, and by which time Apple probably will have iPhone Mark II out.
Well, hopefully iPhone Mark II will have 3G in it, because that's what's really missing for the European market. I mean, because European mobile networks, they're all 3G now, but it's still, you know, quite thin in the US. Just shows how Apple still thinks mostly of the US when it designs products.
Do you think that's fair, Paul? Do you think that's fair that it is a very US-centric product, the iPhone?
Yes, I mean, reports now show, I think it's now the second best-selling device after the BlackBerry itself. And certainly over here, we're obviously very, in terms of networks, we're on 3G already across Europe. I think most people will hold back until a 3G version comes out. And I think that's when you'll see a spike in people adopting the iPhone.
I'd say I don't think 3G is the big problem. I think the cost is the big problem, that it's massively expensive over here. As Brian was saying earlier, that the contracts, you've got to be on O2 and you've got to sign up to a very expensive 18-month contract with O2 to get it over here. I think that's the huge barrier at the moment.
Or if you want it unlocked, you can't get a UK one. You can get them, I believe, in France and Germany.
Correct. But the unlocked price is 1,000 or 999 euro, I believe. So that's about £700.
Kerry, from
a consumer point of view, this does seem to be the big stumbling block, is that you're tied to a not very competitive contract. You can only go to one place to get it and you're locked in for 18 months.
Yeah, that's true. And I think it's certainly putting a lot of people off. I know it would put me off and I wouldn't get one unless I could choose what tariff I wanted it with. Of course, there is this whole issue of the fact that I think you can actually buy them direct from the Apple website and you don't have to take out the O2 contract there and then. Technically, there are a lot of companies claiming that they can unlock it with no problems, but who knows whether there will be problems or not. It's really hard to say.
Isn't there this crazy cat and mouse game going on at the moment with unlocking of iPhones, where people work out how to unlock them and then Apple bring out a firmware upgrade which locks it back up again?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the people who say they can unlock it are claiming there won't be any major downsides, but then Apple are claiming there are, and I just don't think anyone really knows.
Where does this leave the consumer? I mean, if you take a punt and you get your iPhone unlocked and then it gets locked again, do you have a leg to stand on?
If it's in the terms and conditions that you're going to be locked to a particular contract, and unfortunately it's perfectly legal in the UK to do that at the moment, unlike in France where they have to offer it standalone, you're going to be in trouble possibly if your phone stops working.
It's going to have to change eventually, because after 18 months people's contracts are going to start expiring, so they're going to have to make a decision at that point. It's going to be very difficult to force people to recommit to O2 at that stage. Multimedia.
So we move from the iPhone to a couple of other interesting phones that we've been having a play with, both from Sony Ericsson, and they're interesting for differing reasons. First of all, some time back, Howard Pierce, radio presenter, had a look. He wanted a smartphone and was using the M600i from Sony Ericsson. Which Howard liked so much that you actually went out and bought one, didn't you?
I did indeed. So when I saw the new version...
This is the P1.
The P1i, yes.
Looks very similar initially to an M600, which is sort of like a cross between a phone and a BlackBerry in a way.
Well, it has BlackBerry technology, of course, for push emails, but that's just one of the features. Yeah, it's one of the smartphones. Bit chunky, but nevertheless, because there are much slimmer versions on the market. But for Sony Ericsson, it's a slimmer version than what they've done before. It's got loads of new features. It's a very enjoyable phone. I've got a couple of negative things to say about it, but overall, a very enjoyable phone to use. New features include dual cameras. It's also got a video phone in it, so if you're standing with the actual face of the phone facing you, if you're looking at the screen, in other words, there's a small camera to use as a video phone as well. So that's one advance on what was in the M600i. You've got Wi-Fi connection. I like that. It's got an FM radio in it. The M600i didn't have. It's a very good radio. I've been listening, easy to tune, very good sound quality. The earphones, the audio in general, very good sound quality. So that's something. Also, well, it's got all the normal business things in there, because this is more a business phone than it is something the kids will want to use to play games on, although you can do all that, of course. But this has a business card scanner. You take a picture of the business card and it enters it into your Outlook database of contacts. All right, it works most of the time, but it's not perfect. And as somebody that does a lot of business, I want a bit more than the name, the telephone number, and the email address. If I'm going to use this business card, I'm going to take it home and put it in Outlook properly, because I want the full company address. I everything else on that card needs to be there. Tried it several times. Did it work? Nearly every time, but not quite.
How about battery life? I remember one of the things you found with the M600 was that the battery didn't last that long when you were using it. And you, let's face it, you do use your phone an awful lot, but you found that you had to pretty much charge it up every day on the old one.
Yes, I did. I still didn't find that bad for the amount of use I was getting out of it. It wasn't perfect. This is better. So it's got more in it. The thing's running off twice the RAM, so it's faster as a phone. So it's quicker. It's more efficient. It doesn't freeze and have to be rebooted as often. But the power still lasts longer. So yes, that's a plus point.
Now, it had that very strange keyboard. It's difficult to describe, but basically every key is like a little rocker switch, and if you rock a left you get say a T, and if you rock a right you get a V. So it's a sort of a proper QWERTY keyboard, only with each key doing two letters. You like that on the original phone?
I did. I can understand how some people wouldn't like this, but I'm 6 foot two, I'm a big guy, I've got big hands, big thumbs, and that means the little keys on things like the BlackBerry, even on a QWERTY keyboard, I'm forever hitting two buttons or the wrong button or something like that. This has slightly bigger buttons and my big thumbs can hit them good and proper.
The other phone we've got to look at is the Sony Ericsson K850. Now, this is the first Sony Cybershot phone with a 5-megapixel camera. As a phone, it's pretty good, but as a camera, it's very good. As a camera, it's probably the best camera phone that I've used, because it's not just a 5-megapixel camera, but it's also got autofocus and a really good flash on there, proper Xenon flash. Apart from that, it's a fairly conventional shape. It's quite chunky. Unusually, it doesn't have the usual sort of rocker thing. Instead, it's got a large rectangle of raised plastic, which you press left, right, up and down. And surprisingly, you'd think it would be very awkward looking at it. It actually works remarkably well. The one thing I have found with this phone is that the touch-sensitive screen, it's not fully touch-sensitive as you've got on the P1, but you've got a touch-sensitive area for smart keys down at the bottom of the screen. And I found sometimes, if I'm out in the cold maybe, it takes two or three keystrokes to actually activate the button that I want. But generally, the screen quality is very good. The way the phone works is very good. This is where Sony Ericsson seem to be putting a lot of their money in research and development, into making phones easier to use, even when they're quite powerful. I love the fact that it's got a proper lens cover which slides into place, and when you're not using it, the camera, the lens cover itself is behind plastic, and so far I have to say it seems to be pretty resilient and I haven't had any problems with it scratching up. Battery life is good, it's got a very good media player, and some of the games that you can get for it are quite remarkable. The K850 is now available in the UK from free if you get a contract, and I believe the P1's now available as well.
It is indeed, yes. Again, on contract, you can't get a pay-as-you-go one yet. At the end of the day, would I buy one? Yes, I would. It's a great update on the M600i.
Howard Pearce, thank you very much indeed.
Multimedia, the friendly radio show about computers and the net on BFBS. 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 BFBS.
That's two very different phones from the iPhone that we were talking about earlier. The P1 is a new smartphone, the K850i, a camera phone with a 5-megapixel phone. It's interesting, just one more thing with phones, is that looking around the office where we are, we're recording this show from the offices of AdStream, a digital distribution company in the heart of London. And the number of people here who have been saying, we used to have Nokia phones, and up until about 2 years ago, then all of a sudden Nokia, I don't know what it was, but Nokia did something, and everybody didn't like the next Nokia phone they got. What was that about?
I think Nokia completely lost the plot on user interface design. It used to be famed for making devices that were easy to use. My mum is not a technophile. She's not a technophobe either, but she found Nokia phones easy to use. And conversely, you know, Motorola was famous for being hard to use. And Ericsson was somewhere in the middle. And since the tie-up with Sony, and now it's Sony Ericsson, somewhere they've really, really sharpened up their act. They brought in a lot of very nice bits of hardware design and software design and a good user interface.
Okay, Brian Betts, thank you for that. Now, as well as the iPhone, which has got headlines all over the world, it seems to have been quite a good year for Apple, doesn't it, Paul Gibbons?
Quite right. The Intel migration has gone very smoothly.
That's where every Apple machine now actually runs under the bonnet on Intel chips.
Correct, yes. We've seen people now being able to have the best of both worlds, the world of Windows as well as the world of Mac OS X, running side by side and letting them choose between the two.
And do many people do that? Was this a really off-putting thing that they couldn't run Windows, and now that they can, they're starting to say, well, I might as well get a Mac? Well,
absolutely, and we've got a few examples. Apple got some high-profile clients who traditionally have been running on Windows, for instance, a render farm in an animation studio. They then tested Apple's own hardware and found it to run Windows a lot faster than the standard vendors that they would be using, whether it's HP or Dell.
As a retailer, are you finding that the iPod has been an extremely successful product, and every time everybody else tries to catch up to it, they seem to come out with a new product? We've had the touchscreen version, we've had the new tiny little Nano, we've had the one with the massive 160 gig storage capacity. Are people getting an iPod, and then is that encouraging them to look further and to say, okay, well, I've got an iPod, why don't I look at an Apple computer?
Exactly. I believe it's called the halo effect, and people have actually just seen how easy the software is to use, how great the product is, the iPod itself. And with Vista having its issues, I think people now start to question, where do they go next? Whether they stay with Windows or whether they invest in going over to the Macintosh.
Barry Collins, PC Pro has always been very, from the title, a very PC orientated mag, but you have looked at Apple hardware occasionally in the show. How is that faring?
Yeah, the notebooks generally do very well in our tests. I mean, the boundary between PC and Mac is completely blurred now. It's essentially, since the Intel transition, and certainly since Boot Camp and the virtualization software out there allows you to run the dual OSs, it's virtually, it's a technical difference between PC and Mac. You know, anybody can run Windows on a Mac now. So for us, there's no real distinction anymore.
And you mentioned Vista. Vista is the new version of the Windows, or it's the new operating system for Windows. We've had the new version of Vista. It's been out, what, a year now, near as damn it. But people don't seem to like it very much.
No, it's had a real bad start. And I think Microsoft's partly to blame for that. They've made absolutely no effort to market Vista whatsoever.
But they have tried to force people to take it, though. I mean, you try and buy a laptop, and for a long time, there didn't seem to be a lot of choice that still had Windows XP on it.
But that, I mean, that happens with every new version of Windows. Bear in mind, this time last year, the PC industry was suffering a real crisis of confidence, and they were pinning their hopes that Vista was going to give them the sales boost. And when it slipped after the consumer launch, basically slipped into January, so missing the peak Christmas market last year. And I think they were hoping for a lift this year, and it just hasn't happened. And what Microsoft have failed to provide is a compelling reason to upgrade. There's no sort of one good reason to move from XP to Vista. And whilst we still maintain that Vista isn't any worse, and in fact we still think it's a slightly better operating system than XP, the advantages there are very slim.
If anything, you were saying there wasn't a single compelling reason to upgrade. There were a number of reasons to stay where you were. One of which being, if you've got older bits of hardware, making that work with Vista, we've heard over the year, has been quite a pain in the bum to try and get certain things. If you've got an older scanner, or if you've got various peripherals, webcams and things like that, if they haven't got drivers for Vista, you can't get them to work.
Although that was also true with XP.
The big difference, though, with XP is that it was a very, very... it was a major upgrade to the capabilities of the operating system.
Oh, yeah,
it really did
yeah.
change from... We went up with XP. It was a much more secure and much easier to use operating system than Windows 95, 98 ever was.
And it was also a relatively simple upgrade, because it would run on a machine that had been running Windows 2000, for instance. Whereas Vista will run very nicely if you give it two or three times as much hardware power to run on. You do need two or three times as much memory, a lot more processor power, more disk space, preferably a hard disk that also has some solid-state memory in it to accelerate the disk performance. And, yeah, of course, the PC vendors were looking for Vista to increase sales, but they didn't want to do it if they had to double the price of the PCs. So people were trying to sell laptops, which would be fine running Windows 2000, but put Vista on them. And then they were surprised when people said, oh, this runs like a dog, I don't want it, give me XP.
I think that's a little bit unfair. I think we use Vista in the office on a number of, you know, 2 or 3 year old laptops, and it works fine. I don't think the power requirements are that excessive.
But it does seem to be designed to wind the user up. I mean, the example I give is that I try and change the resolution on my desktop, and then it freezes everything and makes me say that, yes, I definitely want to do that. Now, I can understand if I was doing something that would open a security breach in my machine, but I want to change the resolution on my desktop. I don't want to have to keep answering the same question every time I do it. Why does it do that?
Yeah, I think Microsoft has essentially tried to pass the buck on security, whereas...
They seem to be saying, oh, you've ticked OK, therefore, you know, therefore it's nothing to do with us.
Yeah, I think the feature was designed so that if to stop what happens with XP is software automatically installs itself into the background without your knowledge, what they're trying to do is provide you with a visual warning of that happening on screen. And it's now having the exact opposite effect because people will simply click through yes, 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 because it's nagging every 2 seconds. And it's not going to catch the nefarious software when it arrives. I think Microsoft, in private, admit they've made a bit of an error with that.
Now, if Dave were here, I'm sure he'd be sticking up for the new Mac OS X Leopard, which has come out very recently. And it seems to me that the convergence between Microsoft's Vista and OS X continues. There was a point when I first looked at a Mac when I just didn't understand what was going on there. I couldn't, OS 9 was a mystery to me. Having grown up, taught myself Windows, I couldn't work out what was going on. Everything was backwards. With OS 10 and with Vista, they're so close that if you know one, you've got at least a pretty good chance of working your way through the other.
I would certainly agree with that. It's a very strong similarities between Vista and Mac OS 10. We have things like the gadgets versus the widgets. In fact, it's really just a case of renaming the same features that are present in both operating systems.
The other thing I like about Leopard, and I think they did it on the previous version, is that you can get a family pack. So if you've got more than one computer in the household, you don't have to pay out the same over and over again for another copy of the operating system. I think the family pack is, what, 3 or something like that licenses in there?
5 users.
5 users.
So. And that goes across also things like the iWork applications as well. They have family packs for that, and as well as the iLife suite that you buy. If you're buying off the shelf, they do family packs of those as well.
You're listening to Multimedia here on BFBS Radio 2 with myself, Mark Phillips. Our guests are Brian Betts, a mobile technology journalist, Barry Collins, a news and features editor for PC Pro, Kerry Stanaway from the Consumer Champions, which... and Paul Gibbons from the Square Group, one of the leading Apple retailers and service centres. Coming up in the programme, we'll give you the chance to win a brand new Pure Evoke 1S. This is their brand new DAB digital radio, and we'll have a competition question in just a little while. Broadband is something that has swept the UK. It took a long time to get going. All of a sudden, it's everywhere. Everybody seems to have broadband. Dial-up is dying out very quickly, isn't it, Kerry Stanaway from Which?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I think, we do sort of regular surveys to sort of look at broadband and internet usage in general. I think in our latest survey, something like 2% of people, 2% of our members on our online panel had dial-up. Something like that.
2%, so it's really gone down.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's quite that big a difference in the general public, but certainly the vast majority of people who have an internet connection have broadband these days.
There has been a lot of campaigning, especially from yourselves, about broadband speeds, where people are being promised up to 8 meg download speeds, and they're not getting anything like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it sort of started coming through to us at the beginning of this year. More and more companies now offering speeds of, what to say, up to 8 megabits per second. And we were getting our members writing up to us saying, you know, I've been promised these super fast speeds, and really it just feels like it's a complete crawl. Surely this can't be right. So Which did a test of these, and we got 300 of our members to run a speed test every day over a 2-week period, and took the averages. And people who are promised up to 8 megabits per second were on average getting only 2.7 megabits per second, and sometimes it was dropping near dial-up speeds, which isn't really good. This was an average based across tests run at all times of day, not just run in the evening. And even if that is the average speed you get in the evening, if that's the time when you want to use the computer, then you want the advertised speeds to reflect the time that you're going to be using the computer. It's no use to you if it runs at 8 megabits per second at 3 a.m. in the morning.
Did anybody actually get anything close to 8 megabits?
Unfortunately not. I think the fastest speed anyone in that test got was 6.7, so not really that close.
Well, that's more closer than I was expecting.
It's not too bad, but you know, still no one was actually getting the 8 megabits per second maximum speed advertised.
Is it the fact that as broadband's become more popular, and in particular certain offers, for instance, I know TalkTalk have been offering free broadband for life, mm-hmm. as you get more and more people on the same circuit, you start off with a finite amount of speed, and it's shared out amongst, initially it would be one or two people, but you could have up to 50 people all sharing it, and because it's free, everybody piles on at the same time. Is it something like that that's happening?
That's certainly a significant contributory factor. I mean, there's lots and lots of things that can affect your broadband speed, and some of them aren't necessarily things that the ISPs can do anything about. I mean, the major contributory factor for everything except cable broadband is how far you live from your closest telephone exchange. And that's just a sheer fact of geography. If you live a long way away from your telephone exchange, you're never going to be able to get the 8 megabits per second you're promised. Number of people who are online, major influencing factor. If you go online in the evening, there are going to be more people using it. It's going to be slower. The equipment, the quality of your line, the number of people in your household who are using the internet at the same time, all of these things can affect what speed you're actually able to get.
And then, of course, there's what all those other people are actually doing on the internet. Because if they're downloading movies over BitTorrent, or if they're downloading an awful lot of MP3 traffic, they are going to bung up the local network for everyone else. And the providers, some of them have started responding by capping speeds. If they detect you downloading more than a certain volume per week, day, month, whatever, they will cap your connection rate for a few hours or maybe even longer.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, some of them did actually come back and say that as part of it, and they said, we'll only do it for really, really extreme users. So you probably are going to have to really be plugging away, doing a lot of big downloads to experience that. But, you know, if you're told you're going to get a certain speed, you don't want that to happen.
But this was the whole thing as well. The whole thing about capping just struck me as crazy with broadband. It's the whole point of broadband is that you had this fast, always-on connection, and you had some caps. I mean, even now, you can still see some people are capped to like 1 gig of downloads, which is crazy when you think, you know, you could be listening to online radio or watching television, and what's the point of capping it?
It's like the analogy, it's like someone giving you a supercar and you're saying you can only drive it 5 miles per day.
You know? That's true. I mean, what I would say is for some people, 1 gigabyte is enough. If all you want to do is email, maybe do a little bit of online shopping, you're not going to do big downloads. It probably is enough, really, but if you are going to watch TV online, download films, download a lot of music, play online games, that kind of thing, then limits are really no good. And another thing you've probably seen is so-called unlimited service that have fair usage policies and inverted commas, which again, is sort of, that's where the sort of big downloads come in, that if you go over this fair usage policy that is hidden away in the small print quite often, then you'll either have to pay extra or you'll see your speeds really limited, or you'll get a warning letter saying you need to either upgrade or be careful about your usage. So unlimited doesn't necessarily mean unlimited.
One of the things I've found, obviously this program is also a podcast. You may be listening to this on the podcast now. And as a podcaster, one of the things that you find is very important is not just your download speed, but your upload speed. I'm now on a very good tariff where I actually get a fairly fast upload speed. When you're on a slow connection, your upload speed can be terribly slow. It can be 256K, and it can take the longest time to upload a half hour, an hour long show, and you really do need an upload speed. Are people starting to become aware of that?
I think so. Certainly it's something we like Which to make people aware of. I mean, obviously not everyone's uploading podcasts, but a lot of people are uploading photos, things like that. So it's especially with, you know, the increase of social networking sites where everyone's putting their photos online, sharing them with their mates. And as that happens more and more, people are actually making use of the web to put themselves out there rather than getting the information back, then upload speed is going to become more and more important.
You're listening to Multimedia here on BFBS with Mark Phillips. Now, it's our Christmas special, and we will be giving away some Evoke 1S DAB digital radios. All you have to do is drop us a line on an email to multimedia@bfbs.com. That's multimedia@bfbs.com. And tell me, what does DAB stand for? Yes, it's that easy. We thought it's Christmas, we'll give you a bit of a present. What does DAB stand for? And you could win one of these rather lovely. This is the latest version of probably the most popular DAB digital radio there is. And they've gone back and they've revamped it. It's got new insides. It looks pretty much the same, but it's got a brand new display on the front. It looks fantastic. It does all this new DAB text stuff as well. And it actually sort of plays text as to what you're listening to and all sorts of other bits and pieces as well. And we'll put a link to where you can find out more about it on the website, which is, of course, bfbs.com/multimedia.
Multimedia, the friendly radio show about computers and the net on BFBS.
Now, Kerry mentioned social networking, and in a way, this has been the year of social networking sites. Suddenly, everybody's on Facebook. But it's also shown how frail the loyalty of people to a particular site is. We've seen sites come up and almost disappear within the course of this year, haven't we? Barry Collins.
I think the Facebook migration from MySpace has been particularly evident. I remember there was a quote from Rupert Murdoch pressed by a journalist who said, was he worried that people will leave his newspapers for MySpace? He said, no, that doesn't worry me. I'm more worried about them leaving for Facebook. And that sort of sums up, as you say, the fickleness of people on these social networks. It's very much you go where your friends are and move from one to the next. I remember 6-7 years ago, all of my friends were on Friends Reunited. I looked at it earlier this year and it's like a digital ghost town from 2001. Nobody's updated their profiles for 6 years. I get emails every other week trying to convince me to go back because Susie Dent, who I went to school with, has suddenly married Billy. But they're desperately trying to get people back. But once they lose that buzz factor, they're dead in the water.
Which is the hot one at the moment then?
Facebook's definitely the one at the moment, and it's maintained that for the best part of this year, I think. I'm not really seeing any more rising up to particularly take on Facebook. There's others, more professional ones like LinkedIn, for example, which have made some impact in the business world, but I've certainly seen none to rival Facebook as yet.
What is it then? What is the fairy dust that Facebook has that none of the other sites have currently managed to capture?
Well, the reason I like Facebook is, unlike MySpace, then I don't log onto someone's page and immediately get my PC playing all sorts of strange soundtracks. And Facebook is a little more structured. You don't get eye-hurting graphics flashing up at you unexpectedly.
Plus, you don't get random invitations from bands wanting to increase their audience. Mm. You get that a lot on MySpace, I think. You know,
the odd thing about all of these is they have a very particular definition of the word friend. You know, friend could be anything from your boss to someone you once worked with 10 years ago. And I know some people have come up with joke versions of Facebook where you actually have list people as enemies or list people as someone I once met in a pub or something of that kind.
And also the third-party little applications that you get, the little applets you get that you can add to your Facebook page and share photos, your music tastes with. It's all quite really well done, I think.
On the other hand, I do find that every other time I log on, there's a new application. Somebody wants to send me a beer or write on my wall, but then you want to write on your super wall or your extra wall, and it's like, hang on, how many of these do I need?
And every time you want to reply to one of these, you have to load another application.
Yeah, I think there's a real danger with Facebook where it's going to get to the overload point where I think it's starting to happen where if you see on the sort of news stream update you get on the main homepage, and it's now just full of nonsense the entire time, and there's adverts for companies appearing there, and what started off as a reasonably easy way to keep a check on what your friends were doing that week has suddenly become flooded with commercial applications and third-party little gizmos, like you say.
There's been a lot of controversy as well, because for a little while, if you went onto a particular website and you bought a CD, it would start tracking you, and it would tell marketing people what you were doing. And it was one of those things you had to opt out of instead of opt into.
Yeah, I think this was more prevalent in the US. I think the most famous disadvantage of that was some guy's girlfriend worked out what she'd got for Christmas because it popped up that her boyfriend had suddenly been shopping at Macy's or whatever. But yes, I think they're treading a very thin line with privacy, Facebook. And it's stepped over that a couple of times this year, and I think one more big push and it could be in trouble.
On the other hand, they do seem to be listening, at least at the moment, to the force of public opinion. That was stopped, and recently in the UK they've managed to get the what I'm doing thing changed, so that instead of saying you are something, the number of people in the UK who are glorious pedants like myself, and instead of saying I am doing this, it was I was doing this, and you're now able to do that because you weren't. Now in the UK you can actually use the past tense in there.
Yeah, I think there's now an appreciation society for the word is on Facebook because it's disappeared out of those status updates.
Another area that's really grown and grown and grown, partially sparked by the iPod, is the whole downloading of music and downloading of television. And this is becoming more and more prevalent, isn't it?
Yeah, I think this year saw the launch, well, the big one was the BBC iPlayer, which I think has been a fantastic disappointment and enormous waste of license fee money. I have no idea what they did to the iPlayer. I was testing the iPlayer from about 2 years ago on a very early test, and it was a beautiful self-contained little application where you could download the week's previous television and radio shows all in one little self-contained application. And then they launched it in beta form this summer, and they've ruined it. It's now a two-bulb application. You have one part where you choose which programs you want, a second part where you actually physically do the downloading. They're two separate applications, in effect. You need a separate login for each. You need a different login to get onto the help boards. The programs, certainly at the beginning, were sometimes you click on a program, the link was missing. If you did manage to download a program, it would take about 3 hours to download a half-hour program. It's shocking. It's shockingly bad. And since they've announced this, when they announced it 3 years ago, it was a great, unique BBC project. And since then, we've seen Sky, we've seen Channel 4, and other broadcasters all make a much better fist of this download on demand. And they've absolutely frittered away the opportunity they had.
Yeah, I'd agree. It's definitely hard work. I tried to download something, and what I tried to download wasn't available when I clicked on the link, and I tried to download something else. And like you say, it was like 4 hours, and I gave up in the end and tried to cancel it. But even doing that seemed like quite hard work to try and stop it downloading.
Go away. There does seem to be good news on the horizon. One of the things that the current, is it still in beta, the iPlayer doesn't do, is work on either a Mac or on any other form of computer, like a Linux.
My colleague at work is actually on the Mac beta program. And so far, so good. I've not really had much experience, because I believe you've obviously been using it on,
yeah,
on the Windows platform.
I believe they've launched a streaming service that the Macs and Linux can use.
Yeah. Apparently, there's
not
a new
full download.
There's a new Adobe thing, and apparently there's going to be a new form of the iPlayer, which is going to be very much more Flash-based. And I think that's going to be a very interesting thing. Do you think people are gradually going to watch more and more TV online, or do you think that they much prefer to keep their computing and their television as two separate boxes?
I think it lets you watch TV differently, and I think the way people watch TV is generally changing in general, whether it's on your TV set or whether it's online. You're not quite so tied to the TV schedule anymore. There's a lot of catch-up TV on your computer. Virgin Media offers its own catch-up TV service on demand. And I think TV over broadband is just a way, if you missed a programme, there's no other way for you to see it. You can say, oh, well, all is not lost, I can go and watch it on my computer. So it makes life a little bit easier for people.
I know earlier in the year we tested the Apple TV box. This is a box that plugs into your broadband and basically lets you stream stuff from your computer onto your television. And Dave said it was an absolutely fantastic thing. The picture quality is excellent. It's easy to use. Do you think we're going to see more of those devices as well?
I think you are. I think maybe, obviously, it's the second generation Apple TV so far. We may see some further developments in the new year from Apple. I think that's definitely a product to watch out for. The quality, as you say, is fantastic on there. So, yes, I think to watch out for that one.
Moving to something concerned with downloads, three letters which seem to be very contentious, DRM, Digital Rights Management. This is where you download something and it keys into a particular computer or your account, and it stops you copying it, it stops you sending it to other people. The record companies up until now have been running scared of letting people have the stuff they've paid for. That seems to be changing.
Yeah, I think the big change this year came in iTunes, launched its iTunes Plus, and that's DRM-free music of a higher quality than the standard iTunes files, and I think you pay a slight price premium for those tracks. I think the music industry has suddenly woken up and finally realised that this is the way forward. This whole argument that they need to protect the music. Walk into HMV and pick up a CD, well, you can walk away with an unprotected album straight away and bung it on the internet. Why should it be protected because I download it over the internet? Mm. Absolutely crazy. And I think the music industry is finally getting that. Most of the labels now are starting to dip their toe into DRM-free music. I wish the TV industry and the movie industry would do the same. Partly the BBC iPlayer's problems are wrapped up in that DRM. But I think 2007 was probably the year where there was a change in mindset on DRM that's going to have a larger effect.
I mean, there have been some interesting financial models in the past, things like Rhapsody, things like the new legal version of Napster. And I looked at that and it was like £10 a month for as much music as you download and so on, which is great. But then at the end of the month, if you don't pay them the next month, you lose the ability to play it. It's like, hang on, I've paid, you know, I don't want to rent my music or my movies, I want to buy them. And that seems to be something that it's taken them a long time to realise.
Indeed, I mean, certainly Apple, when they first launched iTunes and the iTunes Music Store, they want to make sure they're kept far away from the kind of rental model that you mentioned. And so far, you can own the music within reason, but you still got the DRM. But there's, I think, there's a lot of pressure on them to go down that route as well. But I think the people will vote with their feet.
One interesting thing that happened this year was Radiohead put out an album and basically said, it's up to you what you pay for it. As long as you pay the credit card company charges, you can download it. Has that been judged to be a success?
I think the figures we saw were there was roughly about $2 or $3 on average for people who paid. Now, you can argue that...
Is that that's enough, isn't it? Because they don't have to make the CDs and they don't have to distribute them. Isn't that enough?
It's $2 or $3 more than they'd get if people just ripped it off.
And, you know, there's no overheads. They've ditched the record company, so there's no EMI taking its 20% or whatever. So, yeah, I was quite surprised that the figures were actually as high as they were, even though it got quite a negative press. But do I think all the big bands are going to suddenly go that way? No. But I think it's an interesting development.
It's been a strange Christmas on the retail side with a lot of the shops out in the high street. We're just a stone's throw from Oxford Street in London's West End where we are. And a lot of the shops are blaming online retailers for some of their woes as well as the economy. And online retailing has really taken off this year, hasn't it? Kerry Stanaway from Which?
Yes, definitely. I think people are cottoning on to the fact that not only can you get things sometimes a lot cheaper online, but there's more choice and it's quite a lot easier. You don't have to face the crowds, as you say, on Oxford Street or wherever your local town centre is. And we did an article on it not long ago, actually, and we found you can make sort of really quite major savings by buying online in some cases. I think there was an LCD or plasma screen from H1 TV, but you could save £500 on it by buying online. So some quite major savings. And there are some really good comparison sites out there, so you don't actually have to search around all the individual stores. All you need to do is go to somewhere like Price Runner or Kelku, and it'll tell you where you can get it cheapest. It just makes people's lives easier.
You mentioned price comparison sites. It does make me wonder, there are so many of them out there now. Do we need a comparison site compared to shopping comparison sites?
Yeah, that is a good question. I mean, we always recommend, you know, going to two or three. I mean, Price Runner and Kelku are the couple that we use quite a lot. They're a couple of the biggest, but, you know, you've got to look out for things for whether it includes packaging and postage in the cost, whether it's necessarily the cheapest thing that comes up first, because it's, you know, some of them are better than others at making music search.
That's it. I mean, how do you trust your comparison site to actually give you an honest comparison? How do you know that people haven't paid to be up there in the ratings?
Well, that's a good question, but what I'd say is it's always a really good starting point. If you want to search around beyond that, obviously feel free. Some of the things we looked for, not many admittedly, but some of the things we could actually get cheaper in the high street. So, you know, great starting point, makes your life a lot easier, but you shouldn't necessarily rely on them.
Also, legally, as a consumer, are your rights different when you buy something online as opposed to when you go into a shop and buy them?
You actually have slightly stronger rights when you buy online. It's under the distance selling rules. If you change your mind, I think it's within 7 days of purchase, you can send it back for a full refund, no questions asked. In shops, often they give you 28 days, but you don't actually have any legal rights unless the item's damaged in some way. But the policy varies from store to store.
And I think some of them apply restocking fees of about 15-20%. I know Apple Store Regent Street makes you aware of that as you're purchasing an item.
One of the gotchas with the online shopping, it seems to be that some online outlets are better than others. Last month we talked a bit on the show about my experiences and some other people's experiences with the online retailer La Redoute and the saga of the iPods that, if I can just recap, we placed, I and some, lots of other people placed orders online with La Redoute. We then got a confirmation that the order had been placed and listing the order and so on and so forth, and then nothing happened. We were then, when we went to query it, we were told there was no record of the orders, which seemed very strange. How would they send out a confirmation from their website but then have no record of the order? They then, after we pursued this on behalf of the show, they then turned around and said, oh no, we have found your order, and they reinstated it, but not at the price that we bought them at. And they said that the we also used a discount coupon, and they said no, this discount coupon didn't apply because it wasn't sent directly to you. Why would the site accept a coupon in that case was one thing, but also the fact that doing further research, other people had been given this coupon discount. And it's just crazy as to know. In the end, they said, you know, that they basically wiggled their way out of it and decided not to send the products, but other people did get them, and it just seems remarkably unfair, and that they can do that.
Ooh, that, I mean, that I've not come across that before. It does sound like a very tricky one. I mean, I suppose it would depend if you actually had the record of the purchase, and if the money had gone out of your account, then definitely I would hope they would have to honour that. I mean, that would probably be something I'd need to speak to our lawyers about.
I think that's the thing, because the money hadn't gone out of the account, then that doesn't count as a purchase, I think.
But yeah, there's been countless cases of websites stocking, you know, PCs for £1 accidentally, and people flocking in to buy them, and then the contract's cancelled before the money comes out. And
I think most people are fairly reasonable, you know, and they understand people make mistakes. I think in this case, it's the fact that there was no, oh, I'm sorry, we got it wrong, it was a mistake. It was sort of, oh no, these orders don't exist, first of all. How come we've sent us a confirmation then?
Yeah, you'd hope that at least they'd have the grace to apologise for messing up.
So it's also the scale of the problem when you're dealing with an online shop. You know, there could be thousands of people trying to buy that PC that's wrongly labelled for £1, whereas the same thing can happen on the high street. But probably only one person will try and buy it for £1 before the store realises and fixes the problem.
And also with these online shopping sites as well, such as R-Points and Hot UK Deals, things like that, the word can spread very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And stuff can go up online and literally hundreds of people can grab that bargain or try and grab that bargain before somebody realises, hang on, we've suddenly got a run on this and realise there's a mistake. I have to say, on the opposite way, Amazon.co.uk seem to be an exemplary online retailer, certainly in my experience and the experience of other people I've talked to. Anything, you know, things don't arrive, they really do go that extra mile to sort it out. Maybe that's why they're such a large and successful retailer.
I think Amazon are fantastic. I use them all the time. They've just introduced the new Amazon Prime, where you pay £49 for the year, and all of your deliveries are free, so next day delivery. And you can share that functionality with your members of your household as well. Yeah, right, they've got their own Amazon accounts.
That's good.
That sort of neatly brings us on to Christmas gifts and gadgets. And I thought I'd just, before I whip out a few things I've got here, I'll just go around the table to see what sort of tech toys have impressed people around here over the year. Brian Betts.
I've finally got a Bluetooth add-on for my PC that works. And combined with signing up for mobile broadband, which has been one of the other big things that's appeared in the latter half of 2007, I'm now fully mobile with my laptop. And I think the next thing is I'm going to have to get a laptop with Bluetooth built in, because I keep forgetting to carry the widget around with me.
Okay, Barry Collins, PC Pro.
I think I'm one of the few people who are starting to take a shine to media centres and Windows media centres, which essentially turns your PC into a television recorder and video playback and music playback. And my beloved Pace Twin Digital hard disk recorder has just died completely. So I'm possibly looking to invest in one of those. And I think they're actually starting to make some effort now on the design of these things and make them fit into your living room rather than look like they should fit under your desk at work.
Long-time listeners to the show will know that my favourite gadget ever is my TiVo, which is a brand that's gradually becoming forgotten in the UK. It's very, very big in the United States. It's a television recording device. It's a bit like if you know what a Sky Plus is, it's a bit like a Sky Plus with a brain. And one of the best bits of news I've had all year was that they're going to be putting the TiVo interface into the next version of the Nero CD burning software. So you'll be able to build your own TiVo, which in theory could be the media centre that you're looking for, Barry.
Yeah, quite possibly.
Kerry, I know that you don't really deal with the hardware. Is there anything like you've been... Does it actually physically... Do you really have no interest in the hardware side?
Or? No, it's not that I have no interest at all. I have to say this year I've just bought a new flat, so I'm all about the soft furnishings rather than any tech kind of stuff, but we probably can't get through a whole hour on technology without mentioning the Nintendo Wii, can we? Which I know is the big gadget for my brother and sister this year. They both demanded one for Christmas, and unfortunately my parents are out in New Zealand at the moment, so despite the fact that availability is really rather limited in the UK, they have managed to get hold of some, so they'll have fun on Christmas Day playing with.
I think that's really interesting that the Wii, which is the cheapest of the consoles and in some ways the less technically advanced, has actually really zoomed past both the new Xbox and the PlayStation 3, because they've just concentrated on making it more fun and more playable. So it's cheaper and it's more fun, or that's what everybody seems to say.
Absolutely. My 3.5-year-old loves playing the Wii Sports games, boxing, and it's great. He's actually getting exercise as he's playing it.
And Paul, what for you? What would be your favourite?
For me, I was actually quite impressed with the iPod Touch. One of my colleagues at work was able to, from a wireless network, with a slight few tweaks to it, able to do things like remotely control his Mac from home. And I just love the fact the video quality on there is fantastic. So I think you'll see a lot more people on their trains going into work, heads down on that device, whether it's an iPhone or the iPod Touch itself.
Okay, now I've been given a few things here. A couple of things I wanted to mention. One was the fantastic value of, if you can find them, Cossart iPro headphones. They're not the best headphones I've ever come across, but for under a tenner, they are. The sound quality is amazing, considering they cost $9.95. They're available, if they've still got some in stock, at www.inkclub.com. To me, they sound as good as £30 to £40 headphones, so they're not the absolute top quality, but they are very good indeed. Other things, well, let's see what people think of these, first of all. I'm just going to pass these out. These are, believe it or not, the iPod gloves. You really have seen everything now. These were sent to us by advancedmp3players.com, and they're a pair of special gloves with a wireless iPod controller built in. There's a little dongle that fits onto the bottom of your iPod, but these are top quality by O'Neill, who make all the skateboarding and gloves.
They're not designed for people with small hands. I'll just say that.
I think these are man size, but they've got a little wireless remote, and they've actually got a controller built into the gloves. They're apparently suitable for skiing and for cold weather and all sorts of things. And the idea is that you stick the, you can have your iPod in your pocket, so you don't need to get it out, and you can control your iPod in whatever, you know, going down a mountain if you wanted to. But they are extremely well built. They've got a soft insulating interior. The only downside, if there is one, is the price. They cost £99.
Plus, of course, you probably have to charge them up every couple of days. So if you forget to plug your gloves in, get out of the slopes.
But they fit me perfect. They fit like a glove to me. But they are quite remarkable. Also, other iPod accessories sent down by advancedmp3players.com. We've got this little Roberts DAB remote. We've got the Blue Eye phone and radio on your iPod attachment, where you plug it in and it gives you Bluetooth to your phone, so when your phone rings you can answer that. And a couple of alternative players, people who don't want an iPod and want to see what else is out there. Just reach over here. We've got from Creative, this is their Vision M, which is a little flash-based player. I like the fact that it's got quite a large screen and an SD card slot. It also comes in the biggest box for the smallest product I think I've ever seen. It's a huge, great box. It also comes with lots and lots of accessories, which, of course, the iPods don't. And also this one. This is the quite remarkable Kawon D2. Now, this is a media player with a touch screen. It's about the same size as the little Creative one. It's probably about the same size as an iPod, the new iPod Nano, and it's a lot deeper. But again, it does have a media slot for an SD card. It has a built-in DAB digital radio. And the screen quality on the actual touch screen is quite remarkably good. It really is a fantastic quality. The other thing I like about both this and the Creative Player is the fact that it's got a standard mini USB, and in this case a mini and a micro USB connector built in, which means, you know, you can get a lead for this from pretty much any accessory shop.
Dave Raven and Mark Phillips. Multimedia, the friendly radio show about computers and the net on BFBS.
before we wind up the show, Multimedia for 2007, I'm going to look forward to next year. Paul Gibbons from Square Group, what do you think is going to happen next year, and in particular for Apple?
Well, certainly we're looking forward to the Mac World in San Francisco. That's typically when Steve Jobs will announce the new products. Maybe a little glance at maybe the next version of the iPhone. Rumours always tend to abound, and I think the rumours are of maybe a sub-notebook, perhaps, on the MacBook range. These are obviously only remain rumours until they're actually confirmed by Apple, but sometimes these rumours turn out to be true.
Kerry Stanaway from Which, what about for consumers for 2008?
Oh, well, a couple of good things that I know are happening in the not-too-distant future. It's going to become a little bit easier to keep your phone number when you switch mobile phone services. I mean, a lot of people don't actually realise you can always, almost always keep your phone number, even if you're switching from pay-as-you-go to pay-as-you-go. But at the moment, it takes 5 days. Next year, that's going down to 2 days. In 2009, it's going to go down to 2 hours. You'll be able to switch your phone number over from one phone to another. Another thing that's happening is the BBC and ITV are jointly launching FreeSat services as an alternative to Freeview. So it'll be another thing where you pay a one-off cost and then you get digital TV rather than having to pay a subscription to Sky or satellite. And at some point, probably not next year, but maybe 2009-2010, we might be getting high-definition television services on Freeview. So that's good news, particularly if you're a sports fan.
It's going to be interesting if next year or the year after will be the year of high def. Barry Collins from PC Pro.
Two big things, I think. The first one, BT's rolling out its next-gen broadband network, which is called 21CN, which theoretically offers speeds of up to 24 megabits a second, although, again, I suspect the vast majority of people are going to get nowhere near that. But that's potentially a reasonable boost to the broadband speeds. And we've also seen a lot of media centre extenders, which is essentially taking the video and TV capabilities that are on your computer and being able to stream that to a range of devices, including built into televisions. So you'll be able to beam the video and photos you've got stored of the kids on the computer and watch it on your television quite painlessly with a bit of luck. Something to look out for.
I'm always waiting for you to say, and next year we'll have the Star Trek transporter, and it's never happened yet.
No, one day. We got it for 2009.
Okay. Brian Betts, technology journalist.
One thing we're going to see next year is a lot more mobile broadband offerings. As they get picked up by consumers and used more, we're going to have the same problems we've got with landline broadband, with congestion and contention and not getting the speeds that they're expecting. But the fact that you can do this stuff on the go now through your mobile phone, that's going to really take off next year. The other thing is virtualization. This is something that really the business world's picked up on in 2007. I think we're going to see a lot more of that in 2008. The ability to, in effect, run a computer or an application in software on your machine. We mentioned it earlier, talking about the ability of the Macs to run both Windows and the Mac OS. Effectively, there's two computers running on one piece of hardware. We're going to see a lot more of that for consumers, I think, next year. You can already rent a PC over the web. So if you don't have a machine to run XP or Vista, you can actually rent one virtually and run it in a web browser on your old machine.
All exciting stuff. Thank you to all our guests. That's about it for Multimedia for 2007. We will be back, as always, in January 2008 and with more news of Dave Raven. If you're listening, Dave, do please get well soon. We would love to see you back on the show. Finally, a quick reminder of our competition to win one of the Pure Evoke 1S DAB digital radios. All you need to do is drop us a line and tell us what does DAB stand for. It really is that easy, and you could win one of these superb sets. My name's Mark Phillips. You've been listening to Multimedia. The address to write to is, as always, multimedia@bfbs.com. That's multimedia@bfbs.com. Have a very happy Christmas, and we'll see you next year. Ta-ra!
Send us an email, multimedia@bfbs.com. Multimedia@bfbs.com.
BFBS Multimedia. Accessing the internet.